So in the previous meditation, Matthew showed us Jesus, the divine Jesus, the Jesus who intimately shared the life of the Father. And then he showed us the human Jesus, who's like us in everything except sin. And then we saw Jesus beginning his mission from God by calling disciples to walk, to journey, to live with him. Now we go more deeply into that. We're told, Matthew 4:23, Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, that is the reign of God, and, so that's the teaching, and curing every disease and every sickness among the people. And in the following verse, so his fame spread throughout all Syria. He's drawing on Mark's text, which doesn't mention Syria, by the way. Why does Matthew mention Syria? I've suggested to you already, that's probably where he's writing from, where he belongs. His fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he cured them. And the next verse, obviously introductory verses, the great crowds followed him from, and I've just put a map there for you, you're familiar with it, from Galilee, from the Decapolis, that's on the east of the Jordan, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan, in the southern part of the Jordan. Now I want to show you just for a moment something that I find interesting, and I imagine you will too. Let's look at the right-hand side of that, and you'll see I'm quoting from the first gospel, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verse 21 and 22, and then verse 28. If you look down that side, it reads, Jesus entered the synagogue and taught. Very simple. The next verse, they were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, not the way they're used to being taught by the scribes. Then Mark adds a small scene of a man in the synagogue who is healed by Jesus. And then he concludes that few little verses by saying, Jesus' fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee. Now go to the left side. Now Matthew's got Mark in front of him, presumably, and he wants to write his gospel. So he writes the beginning, verse 23, we've just done them, so I'll do it quickly. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues. Well, you can see that's come straight from Mark. Then he goes on. His fame spread throughout all Syria. We just read that. And great crowds. And if you look right down to the end of Mark's account on the bottom there, his fame began to spread throughout Galilee. So Matthew adds to it, broadens it. Then, and this is the particularly interesting point, I think, on the right-hand side, Mark has a little scene of the man cured in the synagogue. Matthew omits that and places in that place the Sermon on the Mount, the first of his long gathering of the sayings of Jesus about discipleship. And he concludes the whole thing, that's from chapter 5 right through to the end of chapter 7, with words again taken from Mark. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, the crowd were, here it is, astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, not like their scribes. I'm sure you're clear enough to see what's happened there. This is Matthew taking Mark, but wanting to fill in all the stuff he has from the sayings of Jesus, which I suggested to you may even come from Matthew the Apostle. That might account for the name of the Gospel. Chapter 5. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples, we've just seen called for them, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak, and he taught them, saying. For Matthew, the mountain is a place of prayer, a place of healing, a place of revelation, a place of teaching. And I'll give some references, but we'll find them as we go through the Gospel. And we're meant to be thinking of Moses going up to the mountain, Mount Sinai, and there in 40 days and 40 nights of intimate prayer, God reveals to him the commandments, the Torah, including the Ten Commandments. So as Moses comes down with the Ten Commandments, Jesus is going to talk about, we'll see in a moment, the Beatitudes and the rest of those beautiful chapters on the sermon. I'll read in one go material you're very familiar with from chapter 5, verse 3, the Beatitudes. I've translated it in this way: blessed and happy are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Why I've done that is, I don't know how else to do it. The Greek is makarios, and that comes from the Hebrew, which I've got there for you, ashrei, which is actually closer to the idea of happiness, a feeling of joy and happiness and good fortune. And some translations, as you well know, including the Jerusalem Bible, translate these verses, happy are the poor in spirit. And they're right to do that. Other translations prefer to use the word, blessed are the poor in spirit. It picks up the feeling of the passage, but not the word. There's another word for blessed in Hebrew, baruch, which is not ashrei. It's about God's blessing and our blessing of God. And we find the Greek word, which this is written in Greek, of course, from the Old Testament, is the same word we get eulogy from. Eulogeo, eulogeo. Means to burst with joy as you praise someone. And we have a eulogy at a funeral and so on. So it's the same word. So I think to try and capture the atmosphere of it, as well as the accuracy of it, I've decided to translate makarios here as blessed and happy. It would even be better to say happy because blessed. So it's not any kind of happiness, it's happiness that flows from the blessing of God. Enough on that. I'll just now read the rest for you. But notice the present in there. Blessed and happy are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. All the rest of these are a promise. It mightn't be now, mightn't be yet, but it will be. Blessed and happy are those who mourn. They will be comforted. Not right now, because they've just lost a beloved one. They've lost a child. Whatever's happened, their marriage is broken down, they're confused about their priesthood and they're caught between whatever it might be, situation we're in. they will be comforted. Blessed and happy are the meek. Beautiful word in English, we don't use it often enough. Meek means two things to be meek. It means strong and gentle. Real strength. That's meekness. So it's nothing to do with weakness or whatever. It's about being really strong but gentle. So blessed and happy are the meek. They will inherit the land. Blessed and happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They want things to be wisely right. And they're willing to demonstrate for it and work for it and vote for it and write for it and whatever else. So they're hungering and thirsting for a beautiful world. We're not going to put up any more with the way we're raping the world. Thousands of trees every second still being chopped down in spite of Attenborough and in spite of all the science that's there showing us what we're doing, but out of petty greed we're emptying our oceans, polluting them as well, and then emptying our forests, the lungs of the earth. Now that's big stuff, but each one of us, we're going to do what we can. Blessed and happy are the merciful, something our present Pope, please God, is trying to get us to wake up to. All the other things, we're right and we're wrong and we know and they don't know and all that stuff. Why don't you be merciful? Why don't you start from the presumption that God is present in this person who might be whatever they're doing? We don't have to approve of wrong behaviour in ourselves or others. But for heaven's sake, let's listen. Let's be merciful. Because if we are going to help change another person, mercy is going to be the way. Because they'll respond to mercy, perhaps. They may not, but they certainly won't respond to anything else. And with regard to ourselves, if we're harsh on ourselves, not merciful to us, we're only a poor little human being in this vast world, cosmos, then we're not going to change. We're going to be too frightened and too oppressed, etc. So blessed and happy are the merciful. They'll receive mercy. Blessed and happy are the pure in heart. They'll see God. I'll come back to that word see when we come to that beatitude. Blessed and happy are those who make peace. They'll be called sons. Sons of God is a little bit more than children of God. Because all these texts are written in the light of Jesus. So this is not son, not daughter. It's nothing to do with that. Both male and female are called to be son of God. In other words, to live the life of Jesus. To be able to say, I live no longer I. It's Christ the Son who lives in me. Whatever my gender is. So they'll be called sons of God. That is, one with Jesus. Blessed and happy are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, because they've worked for justice. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Again, the present tense. It's already happening in that wonderful work United Nations is doing all over the world and so on. Médecins Sans Frontières, this heroic, beautiful stuff, is bringing about the reign of God. So we begin more slowly, I hope. Blessed and happy are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of God. Here's Psalm 2, which reads, blessed and happy, using the same Greek word, are those who trust in God. Poor in spirit is another way of saying trust in God. We're not our own resources. We're not going to succeed by our own effort. We put our effort in, of course, but that's not the point. It's actually trusting God's action and following it. Again, Psalm 149, the Lord delights in his people. He crowns the poor, those who are, like like a little child, you know, that beautiful psalm, is it 31? Not sure now, but the one that says, like a child, weaned child in its mother's arms, so is my soul. Putting our trust in another, the other. Matthew's focus is on the special white joy which we experience when we welcome God's blessing. Situations that could so easily be destructive are rendered meaningful by our union with God. Poor in spirit, you could talk about that all day, and I'm sure you know hosts about it, but I put this, it's embracing my dependence on the mystery that we call God. Blessed and happy are those who mourn. They will be comforted. Let's look at Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me. The Lord has anointed me. He sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to the prisoners, to comfort those who mourn, to provide for those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes, oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. Rather beautiful description of Christian ministry. Blessed and happy are the meek. I've already explained that. They will inherit the land. And I've got that text in front of you. And that is the text where Jesus says, come to me, all you who labour and are burdened, and I'll give you rest. Learn from me, because I am meek and humble of heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. So Jesus knew what he was talking about when he said, blessed and happy are the meek. They will inherit the land. They won't be distracted by using methods of power that put other people down. Blessed and happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They will be filled. They were the first words that Jesus used in this gospel when he said to the Baptist, you go ahead, please, baptize me. It's proper for us in this way to fulfill all right wiseness. To do God's will, in other words. Blessed and happy are the merciful. They will receive mercy. Jesus comes back to this again and again. Let me quote you from chapter 9 in Matthew. These texts are only in Matthew, not in the other Gospels. So go and learn what it means, he says to the religious leaders who are oppressing people. Go and learn what it means. I want mercy, not sacrifice. Nothing wrong with sacrifice, for God's sake. Dude, go for it. But that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in mercy. Again in Matthew 12. If you'd only known what this means, I want mercy and not sacrifice. He's quoting from the prophet, of course. You would not have condemned the guiltless. And in Matthew 23, Jesus says, and you've got to picture Jesus during these woes. Don't think of Jesus as thumping people or laying down the law. For God's sake, he's crying as he says this. He has to be. He's just longing for them to wake up and do their job well and be lovely with the people and stop crippling them and crippling themselves. He says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You've got it all wrong. You tithe mint and dill and cumin. I'm not exactly sure what two of those are, but you might. And you've neglected the weightier matters of the law. Go ahead. Do your fasting and do all these things. The rituals, that's right. I don't care. I'm not that interested. But for heaven's sake, don't neglect the weightier matters. And what are they? Justice. Doing what's true. mercy, and faith, belief in the beauty of God. The Greek word eleos, which is used here for mercy, this is quite rich, but I hope you enjoy it. When you go back to the Greek Bible, that's the Septuagint, you find that eleos is used to translate three different Hebrew words. It's a very, very rich concept. I'll take you through them. The first is the Hebrew Hanan. You have it in the name John. Your Hanan. Your is Yahweh. Hanan. It speaks of God's gracious care and all the ways in which God looks after us. Here's some texts. And where I put the blue, the Greek is always, the Hebrew is Hanan, the Greek is Eleos. So, the Lord, gracious is the Lord and righteous. Psalm 116, number 6, that beautiful prayer that we use of the priest in the temple. The Lord bless you and keep you. And Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. Hanan, eleos, merciful in other words. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Second word that eleos translates from the Hebrew is a word raham. Now rahem in Hebrew means the womb of a woman. So raham is feeling the, oh God, I don't know, of course, some of you will, please God, what it feels like for a mother with a child in her womb. And let's look at it at its best, when she's dreaming and hoping and longing and all of that that you mothers know. That's raham, often used of God. God is loving the way a mother loves the child in her womb, the way Mary loved Jesus in her womb. Here's the text from Isaiah 63. I will recount the gracious deeds of the Lord, the praiseworthy acts of the Lord, because of all that the Lord has done for me, and the great favour to the house of Israel that he has shown them, according to his tender mercy. Rahamim. Eleos. According to the abundance of his covenant love. And another text from Lamentations. The covenant love of the Lord never ceases. His tender mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. And thirdly, we've actually seen two already, but I didn't point it out because I'll point it out here. There are innumerable texts in which eleos, the Greek, which we're translating mercy, translated a third word, chesed, which places the focus on God's faithfulness to God's commitment of love to the covenant. And here's some texts, 2 Samuel, I will not take my steadfast love, my chesed, my eleos, from David. Exodus 20, I, the Lord your God, will show steadfast love. You could translate it covenant love. It might even be better. To the thousandth generation. An amazing text in Exodus 20. Yes, sin can have an effect to the third and fourth generation, sadly. If I sin, then my children can be hurt, and their grandchildren, and even their children. But that's as far as it kind of goes. But this covenant love goes for 1,000 generations. 1,000 is the biggest number in Hebrew. So that it just means forever and ever and ever. Anything beautiful you do ever, or I do ever, for anyone, anywhere, just has a ripple effect that never stops because it's engaging God's love. And here from Isaiah 54, with everlasting love I'll have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. My steadfast love will not depart from you. The next beatitude, blessed and happy, or happy because blessed, are the pure in heart. They will see God. The Greek word for see in the New Testament is horao. And actually, that etymologically, language always comes from an image, of course. It's the same word as the English word aware. You can even hear the sound a bit, horao, aware. They're the same word. So you could beautifully translate this, blessed are the happy are the pure in heart, they are aware of God. They don't see with their eyes, for heaven's sake. We'll never see God with our eyes because the eyes aren't able to cope with this mystery. But we'll be conscious of the presence, loved in the presence, etc. Here's a Psalm 24. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart. That person will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of their salvation. Such is the company of those who seek God, who seek the face of the Lord God of Israel. Verse 9, blessed and happy are those who make peace. They will be called sons of God. Later, Jesus will go to the extraordinary, I shouldn't say extreme, for most of us it is extreme, but for him it's absolutely natural. He said, what are you doing? Please love your enemies. Don't treat them the way they treat you. Don't go on with all this rubbish. Love them. Now, you may get martyred like Jesus did. It may not work in that sense, but it's the only means you'll ever be able to use to bring about peace, real peace. So we should be now, and we want our blooming politicians to do it, and the politicians of all the countries, we would want them to be reaching out to these other nations that are growing and insecure perhaps and uncertain. Diplomacy must be a very respectful and loving, real, not stupid, not Pollyanna stuff. And please God, there's a lot of that around. I imagine there is. Some of you may have worked in the diplomatic field. But I must say, I'm getting the impression in later years, and I won't say why because it's kind of obvious, diplomacy seems to be giving way to mouthing, bad-mouthing other people. And that's not only dangerous, it's shocking, and it's very anti-Christian. Blessed and happy are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And he goes on to say, blessed and happy are you. So take it personally. When people revile you, persecute you, they utter all kinds of evil against you because of me, because you're my disciple, because you're speaking for me, etc. Keep on rejoicing. Don't stop rejoicing. And keep on being glad, for your reward is great in heaven, in God. Where's heaven? Heaven's not a place. Heaven is the presence of the mystery of God. I suppose you should say heaven is a place, but I don't know what that means. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who went before you. Paul to the Colossians writes in chapter 1, I'm now rejoicing, that's what he's asked to do, I'm rejoicing in my sufferings for your sake, and I'm completing what is lacking in my flesh of Christ's afflictions. There's nothing lacking in Christ's afflictions, but there is something lacking in my part of it. What I'm supposed to bear, the cross I'm carrying, like Simon here, I'm completing what is lacking in my flesh of God's, of Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, the church. And then, this is a big, long, three-chapter thing. I'm only going to do one chapter with you now, so relax. But, of course, there's a whole lot of unconnected material brought in. It's got some kind of logic to it, perhaps, but it's not just a simple flowing, because it's many statements of Jesus made all over the place. Well, these are a couple more that Matthew thought worth putting in right now. You're the salt of the world. If salt loses its taste, how can the saltness be restored? It can't. It's only good for nothing but be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Well, we know this. Salt was used to season food. It was used to preserve. They didn't have refrigerations, and you know that. So salt, that's why salt was such an important trading thing for people who weren't near the sea, etc. And salt was used to consecrate in the temple worship. So they're all relevant to what Jesus is saying to us. You're the light of the world, he said. A city built on a mountain cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel. They put it on the lampstand where it gives light to all in the house, obvious. In the same way, says Jesus, let your light, each of us has a unique light, each of us has a unique song, each of us has an irreplaceably unique way of loving. And if you don't do it, it'll never be done. And if I don't do it, it'll never be done. We're talking about the infinity of God, each person. So let your light, it's not yours because you started it, it's in you, it's given you, it's your being. Let your light shine before others, not so that they'll admire you, for heaven's sake, but so that they can see how beautiful your life is and give glory to your Father who has given you that light. That gift. First letter of Peter. Conduct yourselves honourably among the Gentiles, so that though they malign you as evildoers, because you're not worshipping Demeter, and there was a bad harvest last year, and that was the problem, or because you're not coming to war when you're young enough and fit enough to fight, what right have you got to be a pacifist, etc. They may malign you as an evildoer. They may see your honourable, we want them to see your honourable deeds. Why? Same thing, and glorify God. Don't think, says Jesus, I've come to annul the law and the prophets. These are the two big, the law is the Torah, the prophets, well, you know all about that, and then there's the writings, which are later works and quite important and mostly quite beautiful. So, but he's, the law and the prophets is a quick way of saying the whole tradition of Israel, Judaism, Moses, Abraham, etc. I haven't come to annul it. He must have been accused of this or he wouldn't have said it. So he had to defend what he was doing, because in a way, some people thought he was. He was walking on the Sabbath. He was healing on the Sabbath. He was not fasting on a fast day, etc., etc. He was hugging lepers, and that's forbidden in Leviticus. So he's saying, no, that's not what I'm here for. I've come not to abolish all this, but to fulfill it. And fulfill it doesn't mean repeat it. It means bring it to its flowering. And for the Torah and the prophets to flower, they would have to let a lot of things go, including their human misunderstandings of God's will, which are all through the Bible, Old Testament Bible. I don't have to prove that to you because there's millions of examples of it. I've come to fulfill it. I've come to bring it to completion. Truly, I tell you, until heaven and earth shall pass away, not one iota, the tiniest letter in Hebrew, not one stroke, which makes the difference between different mem and etc., nothing of that will pass from the law. It'll all be there. All its accomplishment will be there. What it's become now. And the disciples of Jesus saw him as the one who understood the law and fulfilled it. Others saw him tinkering with it, and they disagreed with what he did here and here and here and here and here and there, and crucified him. Therefore, says Jesus, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them, as fulfilled in Jesus, of course, will be called great in the reign of God. For I tell you, unless your righteousness, this is the disciples, exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, who are attacking Jesus because of his failure to fit into their narrow confines, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. You've heard, says Jesus, that it was said to those of the ancient times, you shall not murder. True, it's there. It's in Deuteronomy, it's in Exodus. And whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I'm saying something to you. Jesus is interested in our heart, in what happens inside. Not just, all right, I'm not going to murder anyone, but my God, I'm going to, and I'm going to make a mess of everything, including them. I might murder them. But no, he said, no, for heaven's sake, you don't murder, of course. That's extreme. But I say to you, if you're angry with your brother or sister, you're liable to judgment. I won't go into that, it'll be distracting you. There are different forms of anger, and you know that as much as I. And some kinds of righteous anger is really important, and there's not enough of it in our world, or we'd all be demonstrating. So we're not talking about that anger. We're talking about the losing of one's temper when my will doesn't get achieved, or when people think differently from me, or when people behave badly to me, or whatever you call it. If you're angry, you're liable to judgment. If you insult your brother or sister, you're not going to murder them, but you're insulting them. And sometimes I take it's a long time since I'm done, so maybe I shouldn't say, but I have listened to Parliament sometimes. And I think, it's dreadful. I've been a teacher for all my life in so many ways. You'd never allow it in school. You'd never allow children to do that. And yet here we have, so enough. If you insult your brother or sister, you'll be liable to the Sanhedrin, the main council in Jerusalem. And if you call them a fool, well, you'll be liable to hell, Gehenna. I've got to talk about that a bit, because that's clearly significant. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 So a very early letter of Paul, written about the year 50 from Corinth. I used to think it was his earliest letter, and that was a fairly common opinion. But through further study, I actually now think, I may not be right, of course, that the earliest letter is Galatians, written in 48 AD, 15 years after Jesus' crucifixion, and 2 years before this letter. But that aside, let's look at this, 2 Thessalonians. These will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction, separated from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. That's the essence of what the church has always taught about hell. It's separation from the Lord. And the Catechism tells us it's self-inflicted. I think I grew up, and I did grow up in a way, but I was too scatterbrained to take it in, that there'd be the judgment, and then God would decide, and pardon my gestures, I won't gesture at all, you lot are going to heaven, the sheep, and the goats are going to go to hell. Like, that was a decision God made and sorted out. Well, for God's sake, it's got nothing to do with the New Testament. I could prove it if you wanted me to. No. We refuse love. And if we refuse it obstinately and determinedly and against all the grace, like the grace given to the good thief on the cross, which will always be there for us, if I die rejecting God, well, I don't know this, of course, but I shouldn't assume that God is going to wave a wand and change it, because it's my decision. I may not want to love ever. I may have locked myself into this stubborn, stupid place. Well, that's hell. The consequences of obstinate rejection of God's will and God's love are described in the starkest terms, and the terms used are eternal destruction and separation from the presence of the Lord and the glory of God's power, which is, of course, a love power. If I, please God, it won't happen, but if I were to go to hell, our faith teaches us that God will never stop loving me. In fact, God will be crying forever over me, as you would too, and I would over you. So it's a... The consequences are the exact opposite of the salvation and communion with Jesus, which are the main theme of Paul's letter to the church in Thessalonica. We're reminded of the last words of the book of Isaiah. So we're dealing with a long tradition here that shouldn't be dismissed too quickly. They shall go out and look at the dead bodies of the people who have rebelled against me, this is Yahweh speaking, for their worm shall not die, the fire shall not be quenched, they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh. We might need that language to wake ourselves up. When speaking of the unquenchable fires of hell, where soul and body are destroyed, and Matthew does speak about that, Jesus speaks about it, Jesus referred to Gehenna. Gehenna, I forget what's the oldest say, Gehenna is a valley south of Jerusalem. At the time of the destruction of Jerusalem during Jeremiah's time, the fires down in the valley of the enemy camp surrounding the city, those fires were there, and the blood of the people killed was flowing down into the valley. It was a talk about Gehenna is a bit like talking about Auschwitz, or in another sense, where were the Australian Army? What's our Australian National Day? What's the battle we celebrate? Gallipoli, thank you. I kind of know, but won't come. So you talk about Gallipoli. We're not talking about... Gallipoli means a lot to people. Auschwitz means a lot to people, independent of its physical... Because the physical place has so many memories. Well, Gehenna had so many memories of the destruction of Jerusalem, of the end of Judah, Babylon captivity, etc. So Jesus is using the same words that everyone's using for this destruction that Jerusalem went to. Well, Jesus is saying, please don't you go through it. And don't let the world go through it. Punishment for sin, of course, is self-inflicted. God's punishment cannot but declare things to be the way they really are. But where to imagine God making the judgment as Jesus did when he weeps over the city that he loved so much? If only you'd listened, he said, and followed the way of peace, but you've rejected it and you're going to destruction. We're exhorted by this kind of language of hell to look carefully at the direction our life is taking, at the decisions we make and decline to make, and at our priorities. God's unconditional love doesn't take away from us the possibility of our refusing this love, nor does it remove the consequences that follow from such a refusal. We can create a hell here for others and for ourselves. Some people seem to do that. There's no reason to suppose that death will automatically reverse this. It matters what we do. It matters now, and according to Jesus, it matters eternally. What will it profit you, said Jesus, if you gain the whole world but forfeit your life? What will you give in return for your life? The two big destructive elements in the ancient literature were, of course, fire and water. And in the biblical tradition, water, that's the flood, not a real flood, but metaphoric, water. And God said, I'll never flood the earth again. So the literature from then on stopped talking about flood as the punishment, and left anything left is fire. So they use the image of fire. Matthew verse 23 now. When you're offering your gift at the altar, if you remember your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. That's the ideal, and unfortunately, as you well know, I'm sure, it's not always possible, because the person you've offended may not welcome the gift, and it may be too dangerous to approach them too. So at least in our heart, we've got to want reconciliation. We can't achieve it on our own. No one can. And we may be ready to forgive. We may want forgiveness even. But we can't control all that. But if that's in our heart, then of course we go to the altar. Come to terms quickly, says Jesus, with the one accusing you, while you're on the way to court with him. Or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you'll be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you'll never get out until you've paid the last penny. And we used to talk about what happens in society, that they all know. This is not a statement about God particularly, of course. You know what it's like. Well, in these deeper levels, please choose truth and choose good. You've heard what it was said, you shall not commit adultery. So murder is one thing, adultery is another. You're interfering with the intimate love of people's lives. I say to you that if you look at a woman with lust, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. So Jesus wants us to look at people beautifully, not just act appropriately. And this is also serious, that Jesus says, if your right eye causes you to sin, for God's sake, tear it out, throw it away. We wouldn't do this literally, of course. He doesn't want us to, but he's saying, however important the eye is to you, what I'm telling you is so important. If your right eye causes you to sin, then tear it out, throw it away. It's better to have one than to go your whole body and be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, it's the same story. It's also said, he said, whoever dismisses his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. And that's found in Deuteronomy 24, because in their male, and we're still with this, unfortunately, I don't know what we've got to do to stop all this male dominance, but anyhow, their world was male and whatever. So a man could dismiss his wife. A wife couldn't dismiss her husband. She's something he owns. So I'm looking at it at its worst, but I'm sure you understand. But I hope you understand. So a man, but this law was brought in to protect the woman. A man could dismiss her, and then a couple of weeks later think, oh, good, she was a better cook than I've got now, and bring her back. No, if you dismiss her, you write a thing that you've dismissed her, and she's free now. Free to find love somewhere because she wasn't finding him with you. That's the Deuteronomic law. Jesus goes further than it. And he says, I say to you, anyone who dismisses his wife, except on the grounds of unchastity, porneia. It's not over clear what that covers, but there was an exception put in there by Matthew. It's not in Mark, it's not in Luke, but it is in Matthew. Probably based on the experience of Paul, and Paul has a lot to write about this, and very intelligent and intellectual stuff, or because of what was happening in Antioch, because this is always a problem, because people can marry, I don't have to tell you any of this, people can marry, people can become a priest, people can become a religious, to discover that it actually doesn't work for them. It's destructive. Well, there must be means of finding life. So I say to you, anyone who dismisses his wife, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a dismissed woman commits adultery. Porneia, scholars suggest, it seems to me the most probable meaning, is a marriage that's not actually a Jewish marriage. It's a marriage following the pagan customs. It's not in the book of Leviticus and the general culture of Judaism. So he's not talking about people who appear to be married but aren't. He's talking about people who actually have committed to themselves, to each other, in love. I didn't say that well enough because I can't in this brief few moments. If you did want to look, I've written extensively on it, whether I hope it's good, down the bottom there, St. Paul in his 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 to 16, goes into this wonderfully, I think, and I've tried in about 10 pages to unpack it carefully. Chapter 5, verse 33. Again, you've heard that it was said to you, in the Bible there, you shall not commit perjury. You shall carry out the oaths that you've made to the Lord. Of course. But Jesus wants more for us. He wants our heart. I say to you, don't swear at all. For God's sake, stop calling on God to witness the truth. Just speak the truth and always speak it. Of course, as you know, there are times for silence. A lie, which is what we're avoiding here, is when you tell someone who has the right to know something that's untrue. People can ask a question of you or of me, they have no right to know. And we might have to say, no. A husband or a wife asks me, let's say, did my husband go to confession to you this morning? Well, my answer is very simple. No. because there's nothing, they've got no business of theirs, it's someone else's business. That's not a lie, it's a protection of a deep truth. And so there are hundreds of examples of that. We sometimes call them a white lie. And mums and dads and grandmothers and grandfathers are pretty good at it, thank God. They're able to find a nice way of not setting up a harmful situation. Well, back to Jesus. I say to you, don't swear at all, whether by heaven or by God's throne or by the earth and as a footstool, or about Jerusalem and the city of the great king, swearing by your own head. You can't save it. A single hair on your head. No, let your words be yes, if yes is true, and no, if no is true. Anything more than that comes from the evil one. And then extraordinary. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You find it in Deuteronomy 19. And it was a very good law. Because prior to that, if I was a landowner and you were a peasant, and you injured, whether accidentally or not, one of my lambs, I could go in and take your whole flock. And you too, for that matter. Because I've got the power to do it. And this law is saying, hey, wait a minute. No. It's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You can't, just because you've got the power, it's got to be even. You've got to be just to the poor, etc. It's a pretty good law. But it's not good enough for Jesus. I say to you, don't resist an evildoer. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, you're probably coming to them to, metaphorically, to greet them. That's how people greet in the East. Well, us too, I guess. But you offer them your cheek and they refuse your greeting. Well, offer them your left one. He doesn't mean try to show them up, but he means don't you stop loving because people don't accept your love. Stay as you are. Do what you see to be right, sensitively, etc. If anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, well, for God, give me a cloak. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, say to them at the end of the mile, look, I'm enjoying the walk. Would you like to come for another walk? Go too. And don't refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. If I had to sum that up, I'm sorry I've said it so carelessly. I think he's saying, don't react. Don't let other people make the agenda for you. However they're behaving, that's their business really, and it might be affecting you hurtfully, but don't you react to that. You respond as you are, not as you felt when they attacked you. Paul writes in the Thessalonians, see that none of you repays evil for evil, not even an eye for an eye, or a tooth for a tooth, or a lamb for a lamb. No, always seek to do good to one another and to everyone. Now comes the such a telling statement and such an extraordinary statement. And such a wise statement, it's beyond. He says this, Jesus. You've heard it was said, love your neighbour, that's in the Bible, hate your enemy. And there are those words are never used exactly, but there's examples of them in the Bible. But even in the Old Testament scriptures, you find these statements made to, they're not meant to soften that, but they're there. Here we are, Exodus 23. When you come upon your enemy's ox or donkey going astray, bring it back. When you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would hold back from setting it free, you must help to set it free. That's good. Here we have in Proverbs 25. If your enemies are hungry, give them something to eat. If they're thirsty, well, give them something to drink. You'll heap coals of fire on their heads, and the Lord will reward you. I think he means they'll be so ashamed, these people, that you were so kind to them. They may change. Their shame may bring about a change of behaviour. Well, nothing else will, but be kind to them, and it may. So that's the advice given by the Proverbs. Here's Jesus. I say to you, love your enemies. Wow. It doesn't mean feel loving to them. It doesn't mean invite them to your birthday. It doesn't mean have them over for a meal every second night. Love them. And he goes on to actually spell that out. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons, think of Jesus again, of your Father in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the people who are wise and on those who are not. If you love those who love you, well, what's the point? What's the reward do you have? Don't even the tax collectors do that? Doesn't everyone do that? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, well, what's the point of that? Don't even the Gentiles do that? Isn't that how people behave? Be perfect, he says, as your heavenly Father is perfect. The one who sends rain down and on the people. And when Luke has that, he actually opens it up a bit and says, instead of putting perfect, because that could be misunderstood, he puts compassionate. God, and why behave this way? Because this is how God behaves to you and to me when we're sinners and when we're saints. It's a brief hymn. I hope you'll